Welcome back. It's season two of HugeCast. Like many of you, we're having to do things a little differently here at HugeCast HQ, which means we're recording our guests remotely instead of in our own studio, so you might notice a sound difference. But what hasn't changed is that we have some of the best guests to sit down and have a chat with us. Hold on to your hat and welcome to HugeCast season two.
What's the name of this podcast?
Eugene Cast.
How am I supposed to pronounce that?
OIGcast.
A huge cast.
Huge cast.
You're listening to
HugeCast.
Hi, I'm Adam Wendt, your host for this episode of HugeCast. In this episode, I am speaking with Dana Fleming, Executive Director of the Eugene Education Foundation. Dana moved to Oregon in 2012. She's been involved in organizing and fundraising for local schools in an effort to make educational access and opportunities widely available to all students. Welcome, Dana.
Hello.
So, Dana, let's start off by talking about the Education Foundation, Eugene Education Foundation. So you started off as a volunteer and eventually were appointed as an interim director, from what I hear. And then
sort of. I actually got looped in as a school volunteer, and it kind of spooled out of us moving here and thinking we moved from the South, if you can't tell. And we came from Arkansas, and my older two had already gone through school there, and the younger two came out, and I thought, it's not really fair. The younger two are going to have such a better education than the older two had. And we got out here, and I was like, what the heck with the funding? And I was an art teacher in Arkansas, and I was like appalled there were no art classes or anything like that. And I had a lot of free time because I didn't have a job yet. And so I got involved. My mom always taught me that if you have a problem with something, you have to do something to help solve it before you get complaining time. And so I jumped in with both feet and got super involved with parent fundraising in both my girls' schools. And then the job at EEF came open, and it was going to be the staff is really small at EEF. It always has been. And there were actually two jobs open at the same time, the executive director and then what eventually became named as the assistant director, which is what I applied for because it was part-time and it was working with other schools to help them with their fundraising. And that really appealed to me because I needed the flexibility still with my kids being in school. And
right.
I started in 2015.
Okay, yeah. So you were the assistant executive director, which means
yes.
You were doing all of the extra stuff that can't get got to by the executive director.
Yes.
Right? Who was
we're a small but mighty staff.
Yeah, who was
always
the ED
has been
at the
that
time?
Way.
Who was the ED?
It was Rebecca Sprinson.
Oh, yeah.
She and I came on at the same time, and we had such a blast. We came into both our positions without really having somebody there to train us in what we were doing. And so we got to make up a lot of stuff as we went along and kind of forge our own paths. And our board was really supportive of that. And she did a really good job professionalizing everything, creating a new website.
Right.
And so then she moved on to the tech industry for a little while. Now she's at the University of Oregon. And then I applied to be the executive director, which
right.
timing-wise was very serendipitous because I had by then cycled all my offspring through school. So
right.
I had a little more free time.
Right. So you became the executive director in 2019 at the beginning of the year.
Correct.
But as you mentioned, you hail from the South.
I do.
So you moved from Arkansas, but you were born and raised in Alabama, right?
Correct. Yes. Okay. Tiny little town called Bluntsville.
Bluntsville.
Has one red light.
Really?
Mostly all white people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stuck right between Birmingham and Huntsville.
Mm-hmm.
And I sure do wish it was more diverse, but there's always Birmingham.
Right. Well, what was it like moving out here from the South? Had you ever been out here to the Eugene Springfield area?
We actually, my husband and I came out house hunting in July before we moved out here. And August, and we've always loved the West, but to be totally honest, Oregon wasn't really even in my head as a possibility. When I thought of the West, I always thought of like Colorado, Utah, somewhere like that. My husband, when we lived in Reno for about a year and a half in the aughts, is that what you call the 2000s?
Yes, the aughts.
He and the kids, the older two, had gone to visit Crater Lake, and it was like a really quick trip before we knew we were moving back to the South. And he was like, Oregon is amazing. And I was like, okay. I was really busy and really process it. So then the job came open for him out here, and we came out and we landed in the Portland airport. And I'm not woo-woo really, but it immediately felt like home. Mm. It was like, this is where my soul has settled. Right. And so
what we time
were
of year?
More than ready to get out of where we were.
What time of year was that you landed in Portland? Do you remember?
It was in July. Oh, and yeah. It was that year when it was really weird and it had like snowed in Florence in like April. And so that was really kind of shocking because we landed in Portland, then we drove down to Eugene, and then one of the days we kind of made a little jaunt over to Florence, and I just packed summer clothes because when we left Arkansas, it was like the devil's armpit. I mean, it was so hot and humid, and then we got here and went to Florence, and I almost died of heat, of like exposure. It was just so cold.
Right.
So I always think of the coastal weather here as contrarian. I always tell people who visit, like, if you're hot here, you know, just drive over to the coast, you'll probably get cooled off. And if right. you're cold here, drive over and you'll probably get warmed up.
Right. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about living in the valley, right? Is we're right. like nestled between the mountains full of snow and beautiful trees and the other mountains that are on the coast range, you know, and the coast. So it's like, yes. there it is. You get the best of everything, really.
It really is.
Yeah, within 45 minutes, but don't tell anybody.
No, yeah. It's awful.
It's really terrible. Quite bad. So what are some of the other differences that you observed between, you know, the South, either Alabama, Arkansas, and all that, and Oregon? And you mentioned a little bit that there were some differences in the education system that you immediately noticed. Like, can you tell me a little bit more about what that looked like and how it compared?
Yeah, definitely. In Arkansas, we had the school district my kids went to was a fairly large one, but it was like a white flight rural. It started out being like on these farm roads right outside Hot Springs, and all the people who didn't want to go to the school in Hot Springs because they didn't like the student body makeup kind of migrated out that way, and it quickly grew and had a really good sports program, a lot of really good enrichment programs. The school was all K-12, all in one space. It was like a giant junior college campus almost. Mm-hmm. And each grade had like 350 kids in it, and they all just kind of went all the way through those grades together. So there weren't any feeder schools or anything like we have here, you know. It was the Lake Hamilton K-12. Right. And dropping the kids off in the mornings was quite fun. Not really. Mm-hmm. So they were on the bus,
so
because
many
my nerves could not handle that traffic.
Cars and traffic.
It was insane.
How many students in that school district or in that school?
Well, if you, I'm not good at mathing, which don't tell people because okay. I run an education foundation, but about 300 kids K-12. So, wow. I mean, what is that? Can you math in your head that fast?
I can't. No.
That's a lot of kids.
Yeah.
And they were really well known for being a really good school district academically, but it was mostly because of the test scores, and the makeup was kind of diverse in terms of economics. So there were some really rural kids there whose families still lived in the country. And then there were some kids whose parents were like physicians or attorneys. Right. And so it was a pretty broad group of folks, but they really, really hammered home that you better do good on that testing. And mm-hmm. so it was a huge deal there. And so when people complain about testing out here, I'm like, oh, Well, let me tell you, in Arkansas, right before the kids had their testing weeks in the spring, they would send home letters that said, if you're prone to fighting in front of your children, please don't do it this week. And yeah, it was crazy.
It's funny that they would focus on that
stuff, like, you know, if you don't feed them breakfast normally, please consider doing it this week. You know, anything that they could do to get them all ready to fill in those little bubbles. And so there was a lot of rote memorization, not a lot of critical thinking encouraged. Although my kids were all in the Gift and Talented program there, and they did pull them out like 3 or 4 times a week to do some stuff that was a little more that way. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, we got out here and I was very discouraged that there was not the amount of money put into education that there was in Arkansas, but heads and tails content-wise, so much better. My girls are, my younger two are girls. My oldest is a boy. Mm-hmm. And my younger three are girls. The eldest is a boy. But the younger two are the one who went through schools here. And, I mean, they can hold their own in arguments with adults. Mm-hmm. They can, well, not really arguments, debates. It sounds like they're out debate. There trying to just riff with people. But they I think, came away with a better real world perspective than the older two did. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the lack of funding we have here, even though that it's a lot less, I think we make do with it a lot better than probably a lot of other places would.
Right. Comparatively, the amount per pupil and all that kind of stuff, do you remember? Because a lot of folks in Oregon end up kind of complaining about how much education costs. Mm-hmm. When you have that other perspective where you maybe lived in another area and you've experienced another school district or another community's like education system, and you look at the decisions that are made, you know, we have these bond measures that get put up. Was that the kind of thing that was happening in Arkansas as well, where they were trying to raise money or having to raise money from alternate sources, bonds and things like that, and putting things towards the voters?
Yeah, every now and then they would have a bond. And it usually, in the school district where we were, it usually passed because they had the support of the folks who moved into the area. I don't remember them having to do as much fundraising. PTOs and PTAs were really more like
social organizations.
Country clubs. Yeah. Because the people who went to those are the ones who kind of wanted to, you know, they were probably the queens of the playground when they were in school and they didn't want to give up that kind of feeling, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so I never really quite felt welcome at those things. I volunteered in the classrooms a lot, and I actually substituted a lot in the kids' school district. But as far as like getting involved in the fundraising part of it, it wasn't really a necessity. Hmm. I mean, it was like to hand out like popsicles and stuff during recess, more than we need a teacher.
Right. We need some more money for, you know, How was it, since you were an art teacher, how was the art programs in the K-12 system there compared to here? And was that one of the motivators for you? Because I know that it's sometimes, well, arts and sports and things like that are usually the first things on the chopping block, right? Mm-hmm.
Sadly. So right when we moved to Arkansas in 2000, it was a year or so after that, they passed a mandate at the state level that every school have an art and music teacher. And it was pretty big deal at the time. A lot of people were scrambling. There were a lot of teachers who did some, or people who actually weren't teachers, but they were maybe landscape architects or something like that. And they kind of went back and got a Master of Arts in teaching.
Right, right.
And at the time I was considering it, but then I got hired to teach because my degree is actually in art history. I'm not even certified to teach. And mm-hmm. so my, one of my mentors was trying to talk me into doing the MAT program. So mm-hmm. then I started teaching at the Catholic school and they wouldn't really entertain me joining the MAT program because I wasn't required to have a certificate at the Catholic school.
Right.
And so I was like, you're going to get a check. don't you care? Right. Where do you, I mean, who cares if I get a certificate, if I don't need a certification or not? I'm going to write you a check. But it just never quite worked out the way it needed to. And so one of these days, maybe I'll actually get certified. But you can't even substitute teach here without a teacher certification.
Right. Yeah. And so the work that the EEF does here, as you said, you know, like your mother said, which seems like wise motherly stuff, you know, you can't complain unless you get in it and try to fix it, right?
Right.
So when you started getting involved with the PTAs and the parent organizations at your kids' schools, what was it like? Did you feel more welcomed here, and how and what was it about that
That's one of the things I actually love about all of Eugene, not just the schools, is that in Oregon and in general, is that it feels like they really want an engaged citizenry. I was able to jump right in at my kids' schools. I had to pass the background check, but other than that, it was like, come on in, we need warm bodies. And so I ended up teaching, I can't remember the art course. Adams Elementary was teaching it at the time, and it was right down my lane because I, as an art history major, I always try to pair like an art movement or an artist with the lesson that I'm teaching. And my one of my biggest objectives when I'm teaching art is to kind of get kids to really look at the art that we're using as an influence and really, really think about, why did they make this? You know, it's not just doodling, and, you know, there's meaning behind this. What was the context of the time period that this was created? Did this factor into that? And so that was a program really similar to that, that, Adams was already using. Mm-hmm. And, it was volunteer driven and volunteer led. And so we just got to jump in and do that. And it was, you know, kind of already in boxes, kind of ready to go. They made it really easy to teach it. So anybody could have taught it. It didn't have to be an art teacher, but it definitely helped that I had that little bit of extra knowledge, maybe. I don't know. It's not often when I step into a room and I have that kind of knowledge.
Right.
So
you're like, wow,
I try to
take
advantage of it whenever I can.
Yeah, I actually know something.
Yeah. But then I was also really interested in how I could help get more resources to the school otherwise. And there was also not really a super strong gift and talented program. And so I started doing some supplemental art after school for those kids as well.
Right.
So that was fun.
So EEF obviously probably gets tons of money from the state and federal government and is well funded, and there's just like so much, right? And you don't even have enough people to hand money to in the schools that need, right? No. So I'm joking.
No, we're hemorrhaging money. We've got so much.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just like every time I drive to the office, it's just blowing out the windows.
Right. Out your BMW or your Lamborghini or whatever. Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit, because I see it all the time, because I am one of those people that has the, what is it called, Amazon Smile account or whatever, and you can pick your charity. And EEF is my charity because I'm a lazy donor.
Right. We love that. We call that passive donor.
Ah, I thought that was lazy. Okay. Yeah. So passive donor. Okay. So EEF is an organization that gathers up, you know, extra dollars from various places and asks people to contribute, and organizations and businesses and all kinds of stuff. And then how do you handle all of that coming in, and how do you figure out how to make that money work the best for the
community?
Yeah,
that's a really good question. We have two layers of support that we manage and seek. And the first layer is the schools, school-based fundraising. And our amazing assistant director, Jessica Barnhart, is now in charge of that. She inherited that from me, but that's the position I vacated. Mm-hmm. And we really just help the schools professionalize their fundraising. We have platforms, that online platforms, where we can create donation pages for them. We process their checks so they don't have to do it. And we send the receipts out and all that. So as soon as we get that money, goes into our database as restricted, and then we have a lot of layers underneath that where we can really make sure it goes to the right place. And we, on a quarterly basis, send that to the district finance office so that they can get it into the school's accounts.
Okay. So EEF is not part of 4J, but it works closely with 4J by being the fiscal agent for the donations that get received locally for any of the schools.
Yeah, and, definitely. Although some schools do have their own parent fundraising groups with their own ability to do all those things. But one of them in particular, Charlemagne, they fundraise for staffing and they send their money through us a lot of times to buy that staffing rather than going through the district to buy the staffing, because we do keep 10% of restricted donations. And I always think of our money as being arranged in buckets. It's not really. That sounds very unprofessional in, you know, actuality. But the restricted bucket, out of that comes 10% that goes into the unrestricted bucket that then comes out of that goes into the grant bucket.
Right.
And so it's an equity thing. And it also pays, you know, for us to be there to do the work. But the equity part is really important to some of the schools who have the bandwidth to raise more money than some of the other schools. And they know that even when they send money through us, they're going to get 90% of it in their account. They know they're going to get some of that back anyway in grants.
Right.
And so it's a goodwill gesture and an investment at the same time. And how often can you do that?
So you're saying you basically have two, there's many ways that money can come into it, but the two ways that it goes out is that if money comes in specifically for a particular school or program in a school, that that money gets set aside in the EEF in one of the special buckets for that.
Yes.
Yes. And then that school can then utilize those funds up to 90% for the thing that it was designated for. The other 10% goes into the pot at EEF that then becomes and can potentially become grants to other schools and other organizations or educators who have special projects, right?
Definitely. And the level beyond the school level where we receive donations is the unrestricted level. And that is where I go out in the community and try to solicit funds for the schools and the district from people who are not necessarily parents in the district. And so it's so inspiring and so amazing to see how many people here support public education. It's makes my job a lot easier because it's a welcome request and people understand that we need critical thinkers in society, and they see the value in it. So we get, a pretty decent amount of unrestricted donations. And then most of that goes right out from that bucket that's joined with the 10% bucket into grants to schools and district on an annual basis.
Do schools have to apply for those grants?
I'm sorry?
Do they have to apply for those grants?
Yes, yes. And we usually will entertain applications from schools and district level employees in the spring for the next school year. This year, when it came to be springtime, we knew nobody knew what the forecast was, and nobody really had the bandwidth, having just like fallen into distance learning, to even fill out an application. So we kind of tabled that until right when school started. We let everybody know that we were going to accept grants for this year, applications for this year for urgent needs that are distance learning related on a rolling basis. And we review those and approve those pretty quickly.
What do some of those look like? Like what are some of the topics? Is there anything that's just absolutely blown your mind and you've been like, wow, there's some really amazing stuff going on out there, or there's some real demand for something?
Yeah, we were hoping that people would have time to really think hard. I think we've gotten some requests for things to help teachers facilitate distance learning better from their homes, you know, like ring lights or things like that, better microphones, stylus to do like better instruction and as they're teaching. There have been some things like getting books to kids while they're at home. It's kind of been a really broad request range. Everybody's just kind of in their own camps right now and just trying to get through the day. And teachers deserve so many kudos right now. They're spending 12 plus hours a day trying to really just keep their kids connected.
Right.
And the ones who are parents, oh my gosh, I don't know how they do it. It's crazy. So we also, knowing that a lot of people didn't know what they needed immediately, held off on receiving applications for standard grants. And so we just had our first deadline, and we usually get grants, at least sometimes up to five from each school, and then, maybe seven or eight district level ones in the regular years. And this first round, we have not had a huge amount of requests, but they're, very, very thoughtful. A lot of OBOB books, things like that, things that we support for enrichment. But they're also thinking of workarounds to keep kids engaged while they're at home doing distance learning. And so we're also going to have another deadline in January, because we thought teachers might be able to hopefully get a well-deserved break over Christmas and, you know, the holidays, and then maybe they would have the bandwidth to think about what they needed for the rest of the year. And that gave them one more time to apply for through the end of this year. And then we'll hopefully, fingers crossed, be able to go back to our spring reviews for the next year.
How closely do you coordinate with the school district administration or the school administrations?
One of the things on the grant rubric that we use is alignment. And so we hear from the principals, if it's a school application, we hear from them whether or not that really, like, they can rank them. They send them to us ranked. And that figures into the score really heavily. And the district weighs in on that as well.
Well, did you, when you were working this year because of the pandemic, how was the process of kind of making the decision to table the proposals in the spring and trying to kind of see what the horizon looked like? What was that like as far as working with all the leadership in the schools here?
It was, it pays sometimes to be small because it makes us really nimble. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we did at the beginning of the pandemic, it had kind of been on my radar before that. I'd been researching some other education foundations, and we have done a ton of support for enrichment and academic stuff. But we've noticed there's been a disparity a lot of times if a student comes to school and they're hungry, or if, you know, they have severe trauma or anything like that, that they don't really want to know what they're learning in art or music. They don't have the bandwidth for it. And so that really, really showed up a lot at the beginning of the pandemic. Families were struggling. They were losing their jobs. A lot of them didn't really know how to access social services. So the first conduit for them to ask for help was the schools. And so they had a lot of families come and say, we haven't eaten for days, or, you know, there's a lot of that going on. And so we immediately launched a Student Needs Now Fund, and that is going out into the district to families to help with things like gas cards, grocery cards, food boxes, supplies. We had three supply drives over the break, and they were so, so well attended, and people brought food and non-perishable items. It's just been amazing. So that is a really, really good way that we kind of adapted to not having grants and in Richmond and a lot of the things that we had planned on doing during that time. And another thing that people have supported is connectivity, because internet is such a huge need right now. And a lot of families didn't have that. And some still don't. They're still struggling getting some of the families online, but they have hubs at the schools. And I know now that they've relaxed some of the guidelines, they can stay even longer and get more kids in the schools for those hubs. But we were able, with the support from the community, to get families
connected.
A year of Comcast.
Yeah, that's great.
And so it's a lot of bang for your buck when you donate to support something like that, because you're not only helping the student, you're helping the entire family. So let's say their father lost a job because he's in the restaurant industry and he needs to look for a job. You know, a lot of times you can apply online. And so, you know, the child has the daytime to work on his classes, and then the dad could probably utilize that service to try to get a, you know, get a leg up.
Yeah. Yeah. So it kind of raises all ships, right? You know, when you,
yes,
when you bring that.
Exactly. And when kids are stable and they're supported and they feel safe, they're going to be better students. Mm-hmm. And when the kids are better students, they're going to be in a cohort where people thrive. And it really is the tide that lifts all ships, for sure. Another thing that we have just started is generated from a very generous donation from a former school district employee who wants to remain anonymous, but they saw during their time in the district that the need for kids who are experiencing trauma was great. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't have the means to help. And so they have donated $100,000 to start Rosie's Fund. Mm-hmm. Rosie was the name of a student that they had who, the story is horrific, and they weren't willing to share the whole story for privacy reasons, but the child had endured a huge amount of trauma. And so that is starting. I'm writing the press release for that right now to kind of announce it. But I think that is probably the biggest one-time gift we've ever had. And I'm hoping that the community will come alongside and support that. The 4J Special Services, or not special. I always get the name of that department wrong. Student Services.
Right.
I think it used to be called Special Ed. And so I'm getting those two names merged. But they are thrilled. They're so excited. And so it'll provide... like if they identify a child who's experienced severe trauma, they will then ask us for a $2,500 grant, and then we give them the money. They get them help. If they need to get their families involved, if they need to get somebody outside the district as like a child psychiatrist or anything like that, whatever they need to do to get that child stabilized. Because if they call it ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. And you take a quiz and the questions 1 to 10, and there are questions like, before you were 18, have you ever experienced, you know, a wide variety of things, but you know, it could range from like a parent with substance abuse problems to yourself being abused physically or neglected, mm-hmm. all those things. Adults who have had ACEs of 4 or above are 25% likely to have heart disease, and they end up dying about 25 years earlier than people who don't. So it's an investment if we can intervene and really help these students. And again, it's the whole rising tide thing too, because there have been a lot of room clears and all across the country. I have cousins who teach in Alabama and they have them there too. Mm-hmm. And I have a friend who teaches in Nevada. It's there too. I think a lot of students are seeing things at home and they're bringing that with them to school.
Right. So a room clear is basically where a kid, student is, acting out, mm-hmm. Potentially violently or whatever, mm-hmm. and completely out of control to the point where everybody has to leave the room.
Yes.
You know, and they,
for the safety of everyone involved.
Yeah. And that's happening more and more, and that they have been correlating that to the, you know, to, trauma and,
yes.
That's great that donation is coming in and that is going to go specifically towards that type of thing, because that is also mm-hmm. an equity issue in our schools, especially, and in our funding, the way that all works.
Absolutely. Oh, there's one more cool thing that's going on too.
Go ahead, please.
And the cool thing about the pandemic, it's not cool at all. The silver lining in the pandemic cloud is that we are not only identifying where help is needed, but we're able to generate the support to get the help to who needs it. And that was a really clunky way to say that. But
try that again. Yeah. So the silver lining in the
COVID cloud is that we not only identify who needs help, but we are able to get the help to them. And we have the support from the community to do that. And another thing that has unfortunately happened during the pandemic is that the unaccompanied student, the numbers and those has risen really badly.
So let's define that for a second for our listeners who don't know, an unaccompanied or student is a student who is kind of free floating. They're maybe not mm-hmm. still living at home with their guardians or parents. They may be like living on one of their friends' couches or staying with somebody. They've had life experiences that have kind of forced them into a transitional, unhoused, unattached sort of lifestyle, but they still come to school.
They do. And it is their safe place. And that's one thing the pandemic has taken away, is that ability to have somewhere to go where you had a trusted adult or somewhere just to check in, get warm, feel like you are seen. And so in response to that, the district and some other community organizations like 15th Night and Youth Era have worked together with the city to use the space that used to be where NEMA Metrics was, right across from the Holt Center. Mm-hmm. And they call it 44 West because it's part of the address. It's going to be a youth drop-in center. And it actually opens up on the 16th of November. And so one of our board members, the amazing Stephen Perrick, the Access Media mm-hmm. is his company, and they got the place wired and ready to go with internet access. So students will be able to come during the day and check in and work. And here's how amazing those kids are, though. They also were going to, another way they refer to them is McKinney Vento, because it refers to the legislation, I believe in the 70s, that allowed students who become homeless to still attend the school district they attended before they became that way. Mm-hmm. We have McKinney Vento coordinators in the district, and then we also are trying to get CAHOOTS, which the youth version of that is HOOTS, to come in and do some mental health services as well. And so when they presented that option to the youth, because they really consult with them a lot, 15th Night is really good about having the way in on, it makes perfect sense. Why would you not ask the end user how they feel about things?
Right.
And the perspective. So they said, we're going to have for you in the back, while, you're working in the front, we'll have support services available. And they said, the students said, let's don't do that until after school is over. We want to focus on our studies. And so it will be in the afternoons instead of concurrent with what they're doing with studying. And then eventually that room, the back room where they'll be accessing services, will also be a youth hostel, and they'll have to check in every night and check out. But it will be somewhere warm where they can stay. One of the students in the district who was 11 years old was living alone in a tent recently, and fortunately I believe they have found somewhere more steady to live. But can you imagine, as an 11-year-old, trying to find a place to plug in and do your studies when you're just really trying to figure out how to survive?
Right. Stay warm, stay dry,
right?
Yeah. Program note for HugeCast listeners, Megan Schultz, the community coordinator for 15th Night will be an upcoming episode of HugeCast.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, 15th Night is a wonderful organization. And I as mm-hmm. I was actually talking with Megan the other day about the 44 West opening up and how important that's going to be to all of those youth who don't have that safety net mm-hmm. there. And especially right now with everything fraying at the edges, those nets are barely holding anything up.
Oh, yeah. And somebody told me that if the rent moratorium is lifted in Eugene, there will immediately be 10,000 additional homeless people. Yeah. And so it's a huge issue. And again, I keep saying it's an investment, but if we can invest and keep those students plugged in and finishing school and even looped into a CTE program of some sort, they will then be investing themselves in society rather than, you know, needing more assistance the rest of their lives. And the future just looks so much brighter with those options. And just keeping them in the system and plugged in is, I think, so important. Once we lose them to the streets or wherever they end up going, it's so hard to get them looped back in.
Right. And it's a physical and mental health related issue where we have to acknowledge that, right? You know, as part of their education. And the more that we can support that and engage them and keep them engaged, the more productive everybody will be in the future and the more they'll be able to contribute to all of, you know, all of the community's needs and goals. And, you know, it's, you know, there is a lot to the lifetime earning potential type aspect of things. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about equity, right?
Right.
That issue of equity and that, I hate to say this, but I can say it, you know, that not everybody has the same resources to invest in their future. And therefore in this, as you know, as some people used to say, you have to have money to make money. Mm-hmm. And in many ways that's true.
Oh, true. I mean, even if you think like compare a student, like South Eugene has, you know, the reputation of having a certain kind of academic rigor and, even, you know, some students whose parents are probably very well educated as professors or, you know, because of where it's situated near the college, the first place shelter is also there. And so you have students whose parents have very few resources who are also attending. Even if you have a student who, like maybe they even score the same thing on an IQ test, and you compare them like moving through the system together, one has probably been going to test prep. They've probably been paying for a tutor to support their efforts. And the other kid is just glad he shows up at school and, you know, is glad he or she has clothes to wear. And, you know, a lot of the schools have started clothing closets too for those kind of reasons, just to make it so that it feels like the students are equalized a little more. But even like the summer slide, like if you let's go all the way back to elementary school, they've shown studies where kids whose parents read to them during the summer and they, you know, they don't move backward, but they, you know, they're taken to the museums, they're taken to the libraries. And, you know, my kids were so lucky because I taught at the Garland County Library when we lived in Hot Springs, and they would pay me to come in and teach art lessons during the summer with the summer enrichment program. And so my kids had to come to the library with me almost every day. And I loved teaching those classes because it paired literacy with art, and the classes were free to the public. But That's not, I mean, a lot of parents, even for those kind of classes, have to have A, the confidence to sign their kids up and access those services and the bandwidth to know those services exist. I mean, even the things like that that are free are often not as accessible as you think they are when you're coming from a different place.
Right.
And so summer slide for kids who, you know, some kids move forward. And then some kids who aren't really engaged during the summer move back. And so every year you move up at that kind of wonky jaw disparity, those kids are really launching and the other ones are sliding.
Right.
And so we started literacy initiative to try to help with the reading by third grade, because people, did you know that when they're looking to build a prison in an area, they will test the third grade, or they will gauge the third grade reading level of that population, because you can project how many people will be in prison by how, if the, you know, the reading levels aren't great at third grade.
Okay. That just blew my mind.
Right? It's
that's like using data for the wrong. Well, I mean, it's like, okay, so if you're testing them at third grade, get on it. Don't build the prison. Like, it's like, okay. Yeah, that just blew my mind. Okay.
Yeah. And so there are so many instances where you can see that young developing minds, you have to engage them while you can, or there's little places throughout the system where you start to lose them. Right. And so it's just really tantamount to invest in young folks, because they're going to be the ones who are taken care of as old folks eventually.
Right. Well, on that note, I mean, it, in kind of closing today, like, what, I guess my last question to you is there anything that you feel like we as a community need to know about the future of EEF, of the school districts? What can we do to help? What more can we do? And what is coming down the road that you see that we need to be paying attention to?
Those are really good questions. We always welcome donations. Unrestricted donations are really the best kind, because a lot of times we are reactionary to the district and we don't know what they need until they ask. Right. And so unrestricted donations kind of give us that bandwidth to kind of wait and see what they need. Mm-hmm. If somebody has a particular interest, though, like we had a guy the other day who called the office and said, I want to help a teacher who's new, who's probably having to pay out of her own pocket for stuff. And so I hooked him up with a teacher who was fairly new, and she was trying to keep her students engaged, and she's a music teacher. Mm-hmm. And so it was serendipitous, because he said, oh my gosh, I have a clarinet that I need to donate. And so she got a little bit of money to keep from having to spend her own money to support her students. And they got a instrument donated to the band. And so there are some cases too, where, you know, we can pair people like that with a cause. And I mean, Rosie's Fund is a huge example of that. And so there, you know, we have those three things really this year, because of the level of need, student needs now, Rosie's Fund and the Youth Drop-In Center. Those things are super important to support, because there's going to be a lot of things to mitigate once the kids get back in the classroom. They've been out from under the watchful eyes of the mandatory reporters and the trusted adults. Mm-hmm. And not to say that, you know, every student has been traumatized, but it's not a good thing that the number of abuse reports have gone down. It's just because nobody's laying eyes on them right now.
Right.
And the stress levels in the homes right now just adds to that. And I can remember when I was a young parent. I mean, I had my oldest too when I was 20 and 21. And it's hard when you're young and poor and you don't have the means to get through the day and resources that you need. And it just, you know, worry just kind of takes over and you start like sliding into your lizard brain.
Right. And that's so important at that time. Like that's why community is so important, because when I think of the folks out there that are maybe single parenting or have multiple kids as single parents, I can't even fathom how they're handling.
No.
Being at home or potentially having to still work outside the home in a risky service profession as a first responder or whatever, and still have their kids at home who are going through all of these struggles and trying to have just keep engaged. I mean, it's so important that an organization like EEF and the community organizations and the work that like all of those organizations are doing for the kiddos in school, it is absolutely imperative that we all come together, especially around times like this, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I forgot to mention too that our board, because of this year and what it looked like,
right,
really early on, prioritized three things: equity, access, and engagement. And those look completely different for every student. Access and engagement for students who don't fall under the, you know, the Rosie's Fund, Student Needs Now, or youth drop-in center category. It could be like making sure that band is still going, or, you know, trying to establish an esports league, that we're actually looking at that too. Mm. And, you know, anything just to keep students plugged in. They're really worried about their mental health. The district has done really well getting things to families who need them through the wraparound services team, dropping off. They were doing grab and go lunches. Now they're also delivering them to some homes of kids who are home and, you know, they can be home, but they don't have the means to drive to pick something up.
Right.
There's been a lot of really good innovation to make sure that families are getting what they need, but there's still a lot of need left. And once they get back in the schools, we need money to continue to get grants to support things that make learning more fun and make it more relevant, and right, also make it, you know, something that they can maybe use later, like CTE programs. Those are super, super fun and popular. And if a student sees a good reason to keep coming to school when they're in high school, they're going to stay in school. And our dropout rate has really been mitigated among every group except for the unaccompanied youth. And so we're working on that now. And that youth drop-in center is going to help a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's even once we get through the pandemic, there's still work to do. And nobody has any idea what kind of effect this generation, you know, the pandemic has had on them,
right,
not being in school. It's just such a weird, never been there, uncharted territory kind of thing. And, you know, will we lose teachers because they're all exhausted by the time this is over?
We will. We will.
It's a heavy lift for everybody. And so if the community can kind of come alongside, you know, the teachers and the schools and the students, and really kind of make sure that they're still supported. Another thing that we're missing out on is the Student Success Act money was supposed to come in at around $12 million. And it was the first time since I've moved here that they've added money to the budget. And thankfully they still got around $4 million, but the economic issue kind of, and, you know, not having the revenues coming in, they weren't able to, the state wasn't able to give as much money as we had planned on getting. So it was like 3 steps forward, 5 steps backward.
Right.
I'm just kidding. It wasn't completely 5 steps backward. A lot of the mental health supports and wraparound services and stuff, they had already started putting together because of the Student Success Act.
Right.
And so that was a good thing. That was kind of serendipitous too. But it's not as, they're not just rolling in the dough like they thought they would be.
No.
And I say that with air quotes.
Right. Well, so I want to encourage our HugeCast listeners to check the show notes that we'll post a link to the Eugene Education Foundation webpage. I encourage you to get involved in donating to EEF, all you HugeCast listeners. If you're one of those people that likes to be passive, change your Smile account from nothing or whatever it is now to EEF, and donate those little pennies as you purchase. Dana, I really appreciate you talking with me today.
Thank you so much. This is something that's been on my bucket list, to be on a podcast. I've been a podcast groupie for years, and so this is like, I can die a happy person now.
Please don't.
No time soon, hopefully.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you.
And now for some housekeeping. HugeCast would like to thank its contributors, volunteers, and sponsors. A huge thanks goes out to Mark Davis at Eugene Tech for providing guidance and enthusiasm, to Trifoya for providing equipment, space, beverages, and the occasional pizza, and to That Supergirl for providing web hosting. Our producer is Kimberly Noel. Music and soundscapes conceived by Mike Jones. Audio editors include Mike Jones and Christopher Mitchell. Audio engineer is Christopher Mitchell. HugeCast hosts are the amazing Adam Wendt and the delightful JoJo Jensen. If you like what you hear, please give us a review. 5 stars would be nice. And who knows, we might even read your comments during the show. So thanks for listening, or sleeping through it. Either way, thanks.